on swallowing until there was no more, and then, looking at her, said, "I didn't just drink my death, Nell. Try to remember that for me. I drank my life." What I most wished was that my mother could somehow have remembered that, as he'd wanted her to. Hepzibah showed up at the door one day with a jar containing Mother's finger. Mother placed it on a lace handkerchief atop her dresser, between the Mary statue and the photograph of Dad on his boat. Gradually, other objects appeared around it. 3 scallop shells, an old starfish, a sand dollar. It began to look like a small shrine. I didn't ask her what it meant. It seemed wrong, somehow, to intrude. But I felt she was, in some obscure way, offering her finger to the ocean, hoping it might be transformed into something else, the way Sedna's fingers were. One night, as the breezes off Boneyard pulled the scent of the sea through the open windows, I went to Mother's room to say good night. She sat at the dresser, gazing at the finger jar. I let my hand brush across her thumb, touching the scar on her index finger. "I wish you'd tell me why you felt you had to do this to yourself," I said. When she looked at me, her eyes were as clear as I'd ever seen them. She said, "Last February, right before Ash Wednesday, I found dead finger growing on the side of the house by the water spigot. I smelled it from the porch. 2 little plants. The next day there were 3 of them. I'd never had it grow in my yard once since Joe died. And then there it was. I couldn't stop thinking about it, Jesse. I dreamed the leaves were growing through the windows into the house. I had to do something to make it stop. To make everything stop." She lifted her hand to Dad's face in the photograph, and her eyes welled up. "I wanted to make up for what I did. To undo it. I just wanted him back again." That was all she said about it. All she would ever say. She wanted to undo it. She wanted him back. I don't know if I'll ever understand it. Whatever it was she was trying to do by planting her finger in the rose garden and adorning the jar with sea trinkets, it was more than a sad gesture of atonement. It was a last desperate reach for him. I believe that what she wanted was to regrow him from all the cleaved, tortured places inside. To remember him the way he'd been, the way they'd been, before everything happened. She wanted to make the guilt and longing stop. During those days, I compulsively painted my father as I imagined he looked that night, sitting in the mermaid chair having just drunk his death and his life. Using the photograph on Mother's dresser as a model for his face, I painted him with squinting eyes, his face engraved with weather lines, browned and tough as boot leather. That old salt look visible on so many island faces. He sat very tall and regal, as if on a throne, holding the winged mermaids on the chair arms and gazing out at me. Directly beneath the chair, at the bottom of the canvas, as if down in a subterranean realm under the floor, I painted a rectangular chamber, a secret, magical room. Inside it, I painted a little girl. I worked in the living room and occasionally on the porch, unwilling to hide what I was doing from Mother, who would sit for hours and watch with squeamish wonder as his image came forth, as if observing the birth of a baby. I felt that way too, but for different reasons. What I realized was the amazing degree to which my life had been shaped around my father, around his living and dying, the apple peels and the pipe. I saw it clearly as he streamed out from my brushes. Joe Dubois, the hidden, pulsing nucleus around which my life had taken form. "Who's that in the box under the chair?" Mother asked, peering over my shoulder at the painting. "I suppose it's me," I told her, slightly irritated at her use of the word box. I hadn't thought of it quite like that, but I saw how true it was. The little girl was not in a magic room, a lovely room. She was in a box. The same girl who would grow up to express herself through diminutive art boxes. When I was finished with the portrait, I hung it in my bedroom, where it became almost iconic in its presence, in its ability to speak to me of invisible things. It had never been a secret that I'd idealized my father, that I would have done anything to please him, to be the apple of his eye. To use the worst and most obvious cliché, but what I didn't quite get until the painting was the sadness of all that trying. I hadn't understood the small, powerless places it had taken me. But even more than this, I had never completely realized how this same thing had gone on with Hugh. I'd accommodated myself to him for 20 years without any real idea of what it was to have possession of my own self. To own myself, so to speak. I felt as if I'd found the fairy tale pea hidden under the mattress, the thing that had kept the princess tossing all those nights, that had quietly made her black and blue. I would sit cross-legged on the bed staring at the painting and listening to my tapes on the Walkman, thinking what an ideal father Hugh had been. Not just to Dee, but to me. God, to me too. I couldn't imagine what it would be like if I took that away. If I tried to relate to more than his fatherly side. Let him be Hugh. Just Hugh. On Mother's Day, Dee called. I stood in the kitchen holding the wall phone, leaning against the refrigerator. At first, the conversation was all about Happy Mother's Day and summer plans. She told me she would not be taking classes but going home to be with her father. At the mention of Hugh, there was a pause. And then her voice rushed at me, full of anger and incomprehension. Why are you doing this? Doing what? It was such a stupid thing to say. You know what I mean, she shouted. You left him, and you didn't even tell me. I could hear her crying, these horrible muffled sounds far away. Oh, Dee, I'm sorry. It became one of those songs you sing in rounds. I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. Why? She pleaded. Why? I don't know how to explain any of this to you. In my head, I could hear Wit in the boat that day, the precise words he'd used. I never could make them understand that what I needed was somehow to be alone with myself, in a spiritual way, I mean. He'd called that aloneness a solitude of being. Try, she said. There was only so much I could say to her. I drew a breath. This will sound ridiculous, I guess, but my life had started to feel so stagnant, like it was atrophied. Everything shrunk down to the roles I played. I had loved doing them, Dee, I really had, but they were drying up, and they weren't really me. Do you understand? I felt there had to be some other life beneath the one I had, like an underground river or something, and that I would die if I didn't dig down to it. Her silence after I'd spoken was a relief to me. I let myself slide down the refrigerator until I was sitting on the floor. Back there, somewhere, I'd lost the solitude of being that told me who I was, the whole mystery of myself. I'd been incapable of wearing the earth on my arms and legs, of diving and surfacing in my own erotic depths. Don't you love Dad anymore? Dee asked. Of course I do. Of course. How could I not love him? I didn't know why I was saying this to her. How much of it was placation, how much true. Hugh and I had gone through our days with such good intentions, but with the imagination leaking out of our togetherness. We'd become exceptionally functional partners in the business of making a life. Even in the hidden business of being what the other one needed, good father, good daughter, little girl in a box. All those ghosts that hide in the cracks of a relationship. It seemed right to have destroyed all that. Not to have hurt Hugh. I would always be sorry for that. "Are you staying there all summer?" Dee asked. "I don't know," I told her. "I just know that I didn't know whether to say it, whether she wanted to hear it. "That you love me," she said. Which was exactly the thing I was going to say. I showed up at the monastery in the middle of May. The heat had descended in typical fashion, all at once, an oppressive woolen canopy pitched across the island overnight. It would not be lifted until October. Approaching the reception center, I saw a dozen monks sitting on the wide lawn in the abbey quadrangle, hand-tying cast nets. They were spread out in orderly exactitude like chess pieces on a great green board, each with a heap of cotton twine in his lap. I paused, taken back momentarily to my childhood, those days when the monks fled the scourging heat of the net house for the breezes coming off the marsh.
"The air conditioner quit on them," a voice said.
And I turned to find the bald monk I'd met that day in the gift shop when I'd bought Dominic's book. He frowned at me from his huge Jack Benny glasses. It took me a moment to remember his name. Father Sebastian, the humorless one, the one who kept the monastery on the straight and narrow. "I don't know how you get through the summer in these robes," I replied.
"It's a small sacrifice we make," he said. "People don't want to make sacrifices anymore."
The steady way he gazed at me, emphasizing the word sacrifices, gave me an odd feeling, and I thought suddenly of my father. I turned to stare again at the monks on the grass.
"Are you looking for Brother Thomas?" he asked.
I whirled around. "No!
Why would I?"
I was stunned by his question, and I'm sure it showed on my face.
"You don't really want me to answer that, do you?" he said.
How could he possibly know about Wit and me? I couldn't believe Wit would have confided in him. In Dominic, maybe, but not Sebastian. "No," I said, and it was barely a whisper. "I don't." I drew back my shoulders and walked away, out into the cloister square toward the abbey church. The wind had blown snipped off bits of twine all over the place. It looked as if the fates had come through on a binge of cutting. One of the monks was chasing a strand, repeatedly reaching for it just as the wind snatched it away. Something about this filled me with sorrow and longing. I began picking up pieces of thread as I walked, whatever little scraps were in my path, tucking them into my pocket. I could feel Sebastian still there, watching me. I hadn't lied to him. I had not come to see Wit. I was here because no matter how hard I tried, I couldn't resist the morbid fascination of seeing the mermaid chair again, in light of what I now knew about my father's dying. But it was also true that I'd come in the morning when I knew that Wit would be on the abbey grounds and not in the rookery. I had washed my hair. I had worn the aqua shirt. I hadn't seen him in almost a month, not since Mother's hospitalization. The absence had created a strangeness, an incipient, self-fulfilling distance between us that I didn't know how to confront. Much of our time apart had been necessary, dictated by circumstances, but some of it, a lot of it really, had not. I couldn't account for the part of me that remained removed from him. The church was empty. I slipped back into the ambulatory, pausing at the entrance to the tiny chapel. The mermaid chair sat alone, the clerestory window behind it siphoning in a frail, trimmed light. My eyes went instantly to the mermaids on the chair arms. Their greens, reds, and golds were the only brightness in the room. As I'd painted my father, I'd imagined the chair as maternal, the pietà, the immense lap of dying. I'd envisioned the mermaids like exotic midwives on either side of him, their wings conjuring up images of angels carrying him to heaven. Their fishtails, making me think of night-sea psychopomps, bearing him into the dark mother of the ocean. I'd imagine them singing eerie, plaintive songs, crying. Not the fake pebbles in the boxes in Cat's shop, but real tears. I'd thought that when I actually saw the chair,
I would be weighed under by all this, but what I felt was the most extraordinary lightness. I went and sat down. Leaning my head against the twisting Celtic knot, I let my hands hold on to the mermaid's backs. What came first to my mind was the time I'd spent as a child, scattering rose petals around the island as if they were my father's ashes. How I'd especially heap them here, on the seat of the mermaid chair. I wondered if I could possibly have recognized the residue his death left behind, the concentration of goodbyes. Sitting there, I understood so little, and yet much more than I had before. My father had died here, but in a way, I had too. When I'd sat in the chair all those weeks ago, I'd given myself over to loving wit, abandoning my old life. I had begun then to die away. I sensed that Wit had come into the chapel even before I saw him. He called my name. Jesse? He was wearing his robe and his cross. As he walked toward me, I stood up. The knocking started inside my chest.
How's Nell? He asked.
Much better. She's out of the hospital. His face was pinched, and I knew in a way I can't explain that he possessed the same removed piece inside that I did.
I'm glad, he said.
Yes, me too. I felt the moat widening and thought how like detachment the sounds between us were. He seemed to be waiting for me to say something.
Father Sebastian told me you wanted to see me, he said, the formality in his voice unmistakable.
My mouth opened in surprise, but I didn't. Realizing how that must sound, I added, I mean, I'm happy to see you, but I didn't tell him that.
Wit frowned.
A while ago, when I bumped into him, he made it perfectly clear to me that he knew about us. He was very pointed about it.
I felt awkward saying the word us. I'm afraid Sebastian has a nasty habit of reading my journal.
But that's inexcusable. The light flickered in the room. I remembered how it had played on his face when he slept, how he'd washed my feet in creek water. I did not understand the mystifying place where our intimacy had flowed back into reserve.
You know, I wasn't sure until now that he'd actually read it, he said. I only suspected.
I had the feeling when Sebastian was talking to me that he was really asking me to leave you alone, without really saying it. I can only imagine how hard he's made it for you.
You would think so, but the truth is, he's been kinder to me since then, like he wanted me to really do what's best. He told me I should ask myself why I came here, what it means to me to be hidden here with God. I guess he got tired of waiting for me to figure it out, he shrugged. Sebastian is a great believer in facing things head on.
People don't want to make sacrifices anymore. I think beginnings must have their own endings hidden inside them. Gazing at Wit, I knew that the end had been there the first night we met, back when he'd stood on one side of the monastery wall, and I on the other. The sturdy bricks. Wit knew it. I could tell by the way he'd slid his hands inside the sleeves of his robe, the sadness caked in his eyes. I could see he'd already made the sacrifice. We stood there staring at each other. I wondered if I would have fallen in love with him if he'd been a shoe salesman in Atlanta. It was a bizarre thought, but it seemed somehow the most sensible thought of my life. I doubted I would have. And it was disillusioning to me in the sense of stripping away the last remaining illusions. My falling in love with him had had everything to do with his monkness, his loyalty to what lay deep within him, the self-containment of his solitude, that desire to be transformed. What I'd loved in him most was my own aliveness, his ability to give me back to myself. It felt cruel and astonishing to realize that our relationship had never belonged out there in the world,
in a real house where you wash socks and slice onions. It belonged in the shadowed linings of the soul. I had come to the irreducible thing, just as I had with my father, and there was nothing to do but accept, to learn to accept, to lie down every night and accept. I closed my eyes, and it was Hugh I saw. His hands, the hair on his fingers, the band-aids on his thumbs. How real all of that was. How ordinary. How achingly beautiful. I wanted him back. Not like before, but new. All new. I wanted what came after the passion had blown through. Flawed, married love. Whit said, I honestly thought I could go through with this. I wanted to. He shook his head and looked down at a fraying place on the dark carpeted dais. I know. Me too. I didn't want him to say anything more. I wanted the letting go to be silent, to go quickly. Whit nodded. A deep, emphatic nod at something I could not see or hear. He said, I will miss you. I'm sorry. My words cracked as I spoke. I felt I'd been the seducer. I'd sat on the sea rocks like one of Homer's sirens and lured him. Even though he was ending it as much as I felt I was really the betrayer. That I'd betrayed my confessions of love to him, my promise of anniversaries. I don't want you to be sorry, he said. The thing is, I needed. He reached out and touched my face, a place near my jaw. I needed to love you. He could have meant a million things, but what I wanted to believe was that his grief over his wife had deadened his heart, and falling in love with me had resurrected it. I wanted to believe that now he would give his heart back to the monastery. He would go on foraging in the rookery, waking to the sound of frogs in the Bent Island oaks, to the smell of Brother Timothy's bread, catching these little bits of God showing through. It's true of both of us, then. I needed to love you, too. It came out with so much awkwardness, so much ineptness, I felt as if I should go on explaining, but he smiled at me and stepped closer. He said, I told you we'd be damned and saved both, remember? I tried to smile back at him, but it moved painfully on my lips for only a second before evaporating. I reached for him. We held each other without the slightest worry of someone's wandering by. I did not cry, not then. I held him and felt the tide sweep out from the marsh island where we'd made love. I felt a place inside open up, the secret place where I would carry him. And when he'd left, and I was there alone, I felt the pull that must happen inside the egrets when the moon rises in the early dark. That unbearable tug home. I walked to the boneyard beach and sat on a piece of driftwood that arched out over the sand. I stared at the ocean, where shrimp boats were roosting in thick green waves. The tide was coming in instead of going out, which seemed backward and ironic to me. It seemed everything should be leaving, that there should be stretches and stretches of emptiness. I had lost both of them. Long ago, at the all-girls picnic, when Mother Cat and Hepzibah had walked into the ocean up to their waists, I'd watched them from nearly this same spot. I began to picture them out there, the way they'd giggled as they'd tied their three threads together and thrown them into the waves. Benny and I had wanted to go with them, had begged to go. No! This is just for us! Y'all stay back there! Who would have imagined what would come out of the knots they'd made that night? I tugged off my sandals and rolled my pants as high as I could. Despite the heat, the ocean was still chilled from the winter. I had to go in slowly. When the water swelled above my knees, I stopped and dug in my pocket for the bits of twine I'd gathered off the lawn at the monastery. I wanted to tie a knot that would go on forever, but not with anyone else, with myself. All my life, in nameless, indeterminate ways, I'd tried to complete myself with someone else. First my father, then Hugh, even Whit. And I didn't want that anymore. I wanted to belong to myself. I sorted through the cotton strands, wondering if something in me had known what must be done even as I'd collected them. I stood still with the waves cascading against my thighs, elongating as they flowed beyond me toward the shore. Jesse, I take you. Jesse. The wind moved sideways past my ears, and I could smell the aloneness in it. For better or for worse. The words rose from my chest and recited themselves in my mind. To love and to cherish. I took the longest string and tied a knot in the center of it. I gazed at it for a minute, then flung it into the ocean at roughly 1 o'clock in the afternoon, May 17th, 1988. And every day of my life since, I return to that insoluble moment with veneration and homage, as if it possesses the weight and ceremony of marriage. Chapter 35. On the last Saturday of May, I stood on the ferry dock with Mother, Cat, Hepzibah, and Benny, all of us lined up at the railing, staring at the wind-chopped bay. White ibis were everywhere. We watched them flying in boomerangs across the bay. My suitcase sat near the gangplank. Cat had brought a basket of purple beach phlox, Carolina jessamine, and pink oleander blossoms, which she intended to toss at the pontoon when it pulled away, like it was the Queen Mary. She poured lemonade from a thermos into little paper cups and handed out Benny wafers. She had been adamant about its being a bon voyage party. Having little appetite, I fed most of my wafers to Max. "Where will you live now?" Benny asked. I thought of my big, drafty house, the turret and the stained glass over the doorways, my studio tucked beneath the roof. "Home," I wanted to tell her. "I'll live at home." But I wasn't sure I could claim it now. "I don't know," I said.
"You can always live here," said Mother.
I looked at the faded orange buoys bobbling on the water, marking the crab traps, and felt the twisted tie deep inside that tethered me to her, to this place. For a moment, I almost believed I could stay. "I'll come back," I said, and abruptly broke down crying, setting off a whole chain reaction. Hepzibah, then Benny, Mother, and finally Cat.
"Well, isn't this fun?" said Cat, doling out paper napkins. "I always said there's nothing like a lot of bawling women to liven up a party."
Having the opportunity, we fled into laughter. I was the last one on the ferry. I stood at the rail, as Cat had instructed, so I could see the flower toss. It rained oleander, jessamine, and phlox for all of 30 seconds. But I have wrapped and contained the sight very carefully in my mind. I am still able to close my eyes and see the blossoms light on the water like tiny firebirds. I stood there watching after the dock disappeared from sight, and I knew they had all climbed into Cat's golf cart by then. As the island slid into the distance, I stored everything away. The bright expanse of water, the crushing scent of the marsh, the wind soaring in canticles across the bay, and tried not to think what waited for me. Hugh was asleep in his leather chair in the den, wearing black socks worn down at the heels, a book open across his chest. The portable Jung. He'd forgotten to close the curtains, and the windows behind him blazed with darkness and lamplight. I stood, unmoving, startled by the sight of him, a kind of fluttering in my stomach. My flight had been delayed from Charleston to Atlanta because of thunderstorms, and it was late, close to midnight. I had not told him I was coming. Part of it was pure cowardly fear, but it was also the hope that I might catch him off guard, and in those one or two moments he would forget what I'd done, and his heart would fill with so much love it would override every justified reason to send me away. That was my foolish, unreasoned hope. I'd let myself in with the key we kept hidden under the flagstone at the rear of the house, leaving my suitcase in the foyer beside the front door. Noticing the light in the den, I thought only that Hugh had forgotten to turn it out when he went to bed. And here he was. For whole minutes I stood there, listening to the puffing noise he made with his mouth when he slept. Rhythmic, sonorous, filled with the rush of years. His arm dangled over the side of the chair. The little bracelet Dee had made was still on his wrist. Outside, there was thunder far away. Hugh. I thought of a long time ago, the year before Dee was born. We'd gone hiking in the Pisgah National Forest up in the Blue Ridge Mountains and come upon a waterfall. It dropped 20 or 30 feet from an overhang of rocks, and we'd stood a moment staring up at the plunging water, the way it flashed and held the sun, hundreds of tiny, iridescent rainbows fluttering out of it like a swarm of dragonflies. We'd yanked off our clothes, tossing them on rocks and lady ferns. It was hot, the deep of August, and the water still had the memory of snow in it. Holding hands, we picked our way over mossy stones until we stood beneath the overhang with the water crashing down in front of us. The spray was like a driving rain, the sound deafening. Hugh smoothed my wet hair behind my ears and kissed my shoulders and breasts. We made love, pressed against the cliff face. For weeks I felt the water hitting the earth inside my body. Watching him sleep now, I wanted to pull him back into that niche of wild rock. I would have been happy just to pull him into the ordinary niche we'd carved out together with little domestic tools for all these years, but I didn't know how to return to either one of those places, how to make them the same place. I felt amazed at the choosing one had to do over and over, a million times daily, choosing love, then choosing it again. How loving and being in love could be so different. Rolling his head to the side, he shifted in the chair. Sometimes I think it was my remembering that woke him, that the waterfall spilled out of my mind and caused him to open his eyes. He gazed at me with sleep and confusion. "You're here," he said. Not to me, I realized, but to himself. I smiled at him, but I didn't say anything, unable to scrape my voice up out of my throat. He stood, he lifted his shoulders. I don't think he knew what to feel any more than what to say. He stood in his stocking feet and stared at me, a private, unreadable expression on his face. A car went by out on the street, the motor gunning and falling away. When he spoke, the words sounded curled up and wounded. "What are you doing here?" I think now of the 10,000 things I could have said to him, whether it would have made any difference if I'd gone down on my knees and canted all my transgressions. I brought you something, I answered, and raising my hand, as if motioning him to wait, I went to the foyer for my pocketbook. I returned, digging through it. Unzipping my coin purse, I took out his wedding ring. "You left this on Egret Island," I said, and held the ring out to him, grasping it between my right thumb and forefinger, lifting my left hand so he could see I was wearing my ring, too. "Oh, Hugh, I want to come home," I said. "I want to be here with you." He didn't move, didn't reach for the ring. "I'm so sorry," I said. "I am so sorry I hurt you." He still didn't move, and it began to feel as if I were holding the ring across a chasm, that if I dropped it, it would fall through the earth. But I couldn't draw back my hand. It was held by that mysterious quality that appears in cats when they've climbed to the top of the tree, to the end of the limb, and then, seeing with horror where they are, simply refuse to come down. I went on, holding the ring out to him. "Take it. Please, take it." Hoping so hard, I pinched the imprint of the ring into the pads of my fingers. He stepped backward, before turning, and left the room. When he'd gone, I set the ring on the table beside his chair. I set it beneath the lamp, which I could not bear to switch off. I slept in the guest room, or to be accurate, I lay awake in the guest room. As atonement, I kept forcing myself to see him in that moment as he turned to leave. His profile against the gleaming windows, the hardness he felt toward me had risen to his face and tensed in his cheek. Forgiveness was so much harder than being remorseful. I couldn't imagine the terrible surrender it would take. It rained much of the night, coming down in great black wheels and shaking the trees. I saw dawn push at the window before I finally fell asleep, and woke not long afterward to the aroma of sausage and eggs, to the overwhelming smell of Hugh cooking. There are things without explanation, moments when life will become arranged in such odd ways that you imagine a whole vocabulary of meaning inside them. The breakfast smell struck me like that. That was where our marriage had left off that day back in February. February 17th, Ash Wednesday, the day of ashes and endings. Hugh had cooked breakfast, sausage and eggs. It had been the final thing before I'd left, the benediction. I went downstairs. Hugh stood at the stove holding a spatula. The frying pan was crackling furiously. He'd set two plates on the breakfast bar. "Hungry?" he said. I wasn't at all. But knowing his abiding faith in the power of such breakfasts, I nodded and smiled at him, sensing the tremor of some quiet new rhythm wanting to establish itself. I climbed onto the bar chair. He spooned half of a vegetable omelet onto my plate, sausage links, a buttered English muffin. "There you go," he said. He paused, and I felt him just behind me, breathing in an uneven way. I stared into my plate, wanting to look around at him, but afraid I would ruin whatever was about to happen. The moment seemed to hang in the air, revolving, deliberate, like a bit of glass lifted to the sun and turned slowly to refract the light. Suddenly, he laid his hand on my arm. I sat still as he slid it slowly up to my shoulder and back down. "I missed you," he said, leaning close to my ear. I clutched his hand almost fiercely, pulling his fingers to my face, touching them with my lips. After a moment, he gently pulled them away and put the other half of the omelet on his plate. We sat in our kitchen and ate. Through the windows I could see the washed world, the trees and the grass and the shrubs silvered with raindrops. There would be no grand absolution, only forgiveness meted out in these precious sips. It would well up from Hugh's heart in spoonfuls, and he would feed it to me. And it would be enough. Epilogue. As the ferry nudges against the dock on Egret Island, the captain blows his horn a second time, and I go out to the railing. I remember the flowers spilling into the water as the boat pulled away last May. The sad little bon voyage party. It seems now like a piece of history starting to sift into dust, and at the same time, as if I've only just been here, as if the petals will still be floating on the water. It is February now. The marshlands are floods of golden yellow. The color settles on me like the heat and light of the sun. The island will always be the fixed point of the migrating world. Out there on the dock, Max is barking. I think of the mermaids hanging from the ceiling in Cat's shop, the egrets flying above Caw Caw Creek, the bare rose bushes in the monastery garden. I picture the mermaid chair alone in the chapel. The whole island rises up to me, and I have a moment when I honestly don't know if I can step off the boat. I stand there and let it pass, knowing it will pass. All things do. When I told Hugh I needed to come and see Mother to be here on Ash Wednesday, he said, "Of course." Then, a moment later, "Is it just your mother you're going to see?" Not that often, but once in a while, the sorrow and mistrust will form across his eyes. His face will close in, and he will be gone. His mind and body will still be there, of course, but his heart, his spirit even, will go to the outer banks of our marriage and camp. A day or two later, he will be back. I will find him cooking breakfast, whistling, bearing more forgiveness. Each day, we pick our way through unfamiliar terrain. Hugh and I did not resume our old marriage. That was never what I wanted, and it was not what Hugh wanted either. Rather, we laid it aside and began a whole new one. Our love is not the same. It feels both young and old to me. It feels wise, as an old woman is wise after a long life, but also fresh and tender, something we must cradle and protect. We have become closer in some ways. The pain we experienced weaving tenacious knots of intimacy, but there is a separateness as well. The necessary distances. I have not told him yet about the knot I tied in my thread that day in the ocean. I talked to him instead about the mermaids. They belong to themselves, I told him once, and he frowned in the way he does when weighing something he's unsure of. I know at times he's afraid of the separateness, my independence, this abiding new loyalty I have to myself now. But I believe he will come to love this part of me, just as I do. I tell him, smiling, that it was the mermaids who brought me home. I mean, to the water and the mud and the pull of the tides in my own body. To the solitary island submerged so long in myself, which I desperately needed to find. But I also try to explain they brought me home to him. I'm not sure he understands any more than I do how belonging to myself allows me to belong more truly to him. I just know it's true. No. No, I am not planning to see him, I said to Hugh that day. You can come with me if you want. We'll both go.
It's okay. You should go by yourself, he said. You need to go back and face the island and be done with it.
Now, stepping onto the island, I feel myself bracing, feel my need to gather everything up so I can finally lay it down. Mother's house has been repainted cobalt blue. It is practically radiating when I arrive, chauffeured by Cat in the golf cart. She lays on the air horn in the front yard, and the rest of them come out onto the porch. Mother, Hepzibah, Benny. Inside, sitting at the kitchen table, I look at them and see how everything continues and equally how it changes. Mother tells me how Cat takes her across the bay every month to see the doctor, that she is on much less medication now. Her finger is still in the jar of alcohol on her dresser. Last August, she went back to her passion for feeding the monks, abandoning Julia Child for James Beard.
The monks miss Julia's food, she tells me, but they'll get over it.
When I ask Hepzibah about the Grand Gullah tour, she sits straighter in her African print dress and tells me it's listed these days in all the tourist magazines in Charleston, that she may have to offer it every single day by the time summer comes around. Cat surprises me most. She has written up her own booklet to sell along with Dominic's in The Mermaid's Tale, called Island Dog. It's the legendary story of Max meeting the fairy every day with unfailing precision. Shaking her head and causing her precarious hairdo to slide out of its combs, she announces that she and Max will be on television news next week. Benny adds that Max is excited and not at all nervous. They want to talk about my paintings, so I let them. I've lost my shyness about all that. Cat chirps about my diving women's show at the Phoebe Pember Gallery in Charleston last October. I had her to thank for it. She was the one who packed all the paintings I'd left behind and took them to the gallery owner herself.
I knew she would want them, she said.
I hadn't come for the opening. I wasn't ready to come back then, but the egretiers had gone and stood in for me. I am working now on a series of island landscapes. Once in a while, though, I stop and paint one of my quirky mermaids for Cat, just to make her happy. The last one was of a real mermaid working as a saleswoman inside Cat's own shop. She stands behind the counter selling mermaid trinkets to the tourists, wearing a T-shirt that says, The Mermaid's Tale. When Mother asks about Dee, I don't know how much to say. The truth is that Dee was shaken by what happened between Hugh and me. There was a brief period at the end of last summer when she talked about withdrawing from school, taking a semester off. I think she only wanted to be near us, to protect us somehow, as if she bore some responsibility in it all. We had to sit her down and tell her we would be okay, better than okay, that our problems had had nothing to do with her, only with ourselves. In the end, she'd gone back to Vanderbilt, more serious, more grown up. Despite that, she called before I left home to say she was writing Hugh's birthday song, If Sofas Could Talk. What I tell Mother is that Dee has switched her major from English to pre-med, that she has decided to be a psychiatrist like Hugh. Mother wants to know if Dee's decision has anything to do with what she did to her fingers. No, I say. I think it has more to do with what I did. I laugh. But there's truth in it. The five of us talk all afternoon, till the sky darkens and the palmettos make pronged shadows at the window. As they are leaving, Cat tugs me aside over to a private place in the yard beside the bathtub Mary. She hands me a tan canvas bag, which I recognize instantly. It is the one Wit carried in the John boat on Rookery Rounds. Dominic brought this to the shop a couple of weeks ago, she says. He asked me to give it to you. I do not open it then, but wait until Mother is asleep and I am alone in my room. I take everything out and lay it across the bed. Four dried brown apple peels tucked inside a plastic bag. A battered box of mermaid tears. White egret feathers. The turtle skull. My father's pipe. All the things I'd left inside the crab trap in Witt's Hermitage are here. During the past year, not a week had gone by that I didn't think about them, wishing I could have managed to go back for them. Witt's letter is at the bottom of the bag.
Dear Jessie, I am returning your things. I have kept them all this time in my cottage, thinking I would give them to you myself when you return to the island. I didn't want to intrude on your life in Atlanta by sending them in the mail. I felt when you were ready, you would return for them. I am not here, however, to give them to you in person. I will leave the monastery February 1st. I took solemn vows last August, but, ironically enough, decided at Christmas that I would not stay after all. I want to be in the world again. I understand now that a large part of me is not so much hidden here with God, but hiding. I have decided to take back the hazard of life. I came here wanting God, but, truthfully, I was also looking for some kind of immunity from life. There is none. And, of course, I may find that God is out there, too. Dominic reminded me that God is the one whose center is everywhere and circumference is nowhere. I'll go see if he's right. At first it was difficult for me to go back to the Hermitage, to remember you there, to realize I would know you only as a memory or a longing. But finally, I'm able to think of our time together without regret. You brought me deeper into life. How could I regret that? I want you to be well.
Please, be happy. Your wit.
I sit in my mother's blue house and cry into my hands. When that is done, I close the long year of my life, knowing it will stay with me like the turtle skull worn down by the sea, shining and white-boned. The last thing Hugh said to me when I left was this.
You are coming back this time, right?
He was smiling, teasing, wanting to lighten the tension we both felt at my returning. I look toward the window. I want to tell him, yes, I'm coming back, Hugh. When I die, it will be your face I see hovering over me, whether in flesh or in memory. Don't you know? What I want is you. What I want is the enduring, the beautiful enduring.
Author's note. The Mermaid Chair is a work of fiction. The story, the characters, and the setting come purely from my imagination. I've imagined Egret Island as part of the beautiful necklace of barrier islands along the coast of South Carolina, but you will not find the island on a map. It's not a real place. Nevertheless, it's similar to existing South Carolina islands when it comes to its beach, maritime forest, tidal marshes, estuaries, creeks, birds, and animals. I drew on numerous natural history and nature guidebooks. Todd Ballantyne's Tideland Treasure was particularly useful. All the plants, trees, and flora referred to in the book are real, though I took the liberty of inventing one fictitious plant that you will be able to distinguish in retrospect. I've explored numerous barrier islands in South Carolina, but it was Bull Island, an uninhabited and pristine place that was often in the back of my mind as I wrote. Not only did I position Egret Island geographically where Bull Island is located on South Carolina's coastline, I also borrowed the name of Bull Island's magnificent beach, Boneyard. Saint Eudoria is not a real saint in the Catholic Church, as far as I know, though I based her story on accounts of saints who mutilated their bodies in the pursuit of holiness. The legend of Sedna is a genuine Native American tale from the Inuit people, which has several variations. In recounting the story in the novel, I have attempted to be true to its source. The monastery of St. Sanara is non-existent. In writing about it, I've relied on a list of books too long to enumerate, and on my years of study of contemplative spirituality and the monastic life. The Gullah culture, which is referred to in the novel, is a distinct heritage belonging to African-American descendants of slaves who settled along the southeast coast. The culture contains its own customs, food, art, and language, some of which appear in the novel. The Gullah phrases that I've used are part of the Gullah language still spoken in parts of South Carolina. I'm grateful to the wonderful book Gullah Cultural Legacies by Emery S. Campbell. This novel began one summer day in 2001 when my friend Sherry Tyree mentioned that she'd seen a mermaid chair during a visit to England. I'm deeply grateful to her for this chance comment, which led me to the chair that sits in St. Sanara Church in the ancient village of Zanor, in the beautiful and magical land of Cornwall. The chair is made from two 15th-century bench ends, one of which is carved with a mysterious mermaid. The carving is associated with the fabled mermaid of Zanor, who fell in love with one of the church's choristers, then lured him into the sea. Little historical information is available about Saint Sanara, the saint for whom the Cornish church is named, but I was intrigued by a legend suggesting that before Sanara's conversion, she was a Celtic princess named Asinora. Armed with these two morsels of inspiration, the historical mermaid chair and the bit of lore about Sanara and Asinora, I began to weave my own story. I created a distinctly different mermaid chair for the novel, different in appearance,
in history and in the mythology that surrounds it, though I did use some fragments from the Mermaid of Zanor myth. I am indebted and grateful to St. Zanor Church in Cornwall, for without its famous chair, this novel could not have been written. Finally, I would like to acknowledge two books that became my companions as I immersed myself in the symbolism, mythology, art, and history of mermaids. Sirens by Mary Lau and Mermaids, compiled by Elizabeth Radiseau. This is Eliza Foss. We hope that you've enjoyed this production of The Mermaid Chair by Sue Monk Kidd. This program was executive produced by Patty Peruse and produced and directed by John McElroy. The Mermaid Chair is a production of Penguin Audio. Copyright 2005. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.